This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Later on today's show, we'll have the Mount Airy Museum of Regional History's Executive Director, Matt Edwards. He'll be talking with David Ford about the new exhibit, Hometown Teams, How Sports Shape America. We'll have a little music for flute, viola, and harp with Winston-Salem's Fire Pink Trio. Then we'll go behind the scenes with Mary Dalton for her take on 50 Shades of Grey. But first, let's go on a musical voyage with one of Winston-Salem's newest bands. The self-described experimental rock band Aquatic Ceremony have been swimming in the seas of the triad music scene for just over a year. Led by the vibrant and dynamic vocalist Amy Fitzgerald, the band's music is at times reflective, with washes of serene guitars punctuated by Amy's introspective lyrics. Then, at other times, Aquatic Ceremony takes on the guise of a space crew, steering its way out of an anxiety dream in the furthest reaches of the galaxy. These extremes and the band's sharp musicianship are in focus and on display on their recently released debut album. The self-titled CD features Matt Cooley on guitar, Eric Glenn on bass, Chad McHenry on drums, and Amy Fitzgerald on vocals. Amy and Chad spoke with me at the studios of WFDD.
The beginning of 2014, my New Year's resolution was to make music as much as I possibly could. And it just so happened that I was living in a house where an instrumental band was practicing. Mm-hmm. And I had three notebooks full of lyrics. And one day I finally was like, I gotta do this. You know, I was listening to them practicing. And I came in the room and I was like, I think I might be able to sing some lyrics to one of those songs that you guys are doing.
You two had been housemates for 3 or 4 years, yeah. But this was the first time we got together musically at all.
She has some solo stuff that she writes, and I've played drums with her before. Like,
yeah, I used to busk on the street, actually, before they got a little bit more uptight about that. I don't know if that's the right word to use, but I would just play covers and original songs in the street.
From what you were doing then to what you're doing now with Aquatic Ceremony.
Very different.
Very different and a huge leap.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So tell me about that journey, how you got from doing acoustic songs to being this in-your-face front woman.
I think for me is that I enjoy the performance of music, like the physical performance of music, and I always kind of felt like playing an instrument kind of hindered that. And so eventually, with Aquatic Ceremony, I was able to explore more of like the physical movement of music, and like when I perform, I'm able to try and translate even the meaning of the songs through how I move, and I like being able to explore that side of it.
And with your vocals, you're obviously a great singer, but you're using lots of effects too in creative ways.
Yeah, that actually was a big part of making Aquatic Ceremony what it was as well. I actually got a Boss VE20 vocal processor around the same time that I started making music with them. I think it was literally 2 weeks after I started singing with them that I got that. It gives me the ability to create harmonies on the spot. There's actually a button I can push to allow myself to hear a harmony with what I'm already singing. And then there's also, my favorite thing is just the looping effect, the fact that I can record a vocal phrase and then harmonize with myself, or like record some other kind of vocal texture over an existing vocal sound. So a lot of our music is more about, we call it creating soundscapes, layering sounds on top of each other, whether it's through guitar pedals or Chad uses a drum machine sometimes and synthesizer. And then for me, it's vocals, just layering the vocal effects and trying to make it a very full and exciting sound.
Well, that sound is really hard to pigeonhole, which mm-hmm. is a good thing. Did you set out with a certain style in mind or mood or mm-hmm. what was...
No.
You just went for it.
We yeah. all have very different tastes in music, I mm-hmm. think, but also it overlaps a little bit.
Well, and I think that's the reason why whenever people ask that question and you have to give an answer, my answer is always just experimental. And I think that does yeah. have some connotations. People are like, oh, that means it's just like really weird, you know, which it kind of is, but that doesn't have to be a bad thing. No. You know, like I feel like if you're open-minded about it, then it's something that can also be palatable to a wide audience, I think, but... We never limit ourselves, I guess.
Right.
So the first two songs, it's a 6-song album.
Yes.
And the first two are Web. And Spider.
Yeah.
So you have like an arachnid fascination? Kind
of actually, no. It just kind of happened.
Yeah.
And I think for the song Web, I don't think that one ever actually mentions a spider. I think that one's more just using the image of a web kind of to represent like human connections. And for me, I always actually used to be very introverted. And... becoming a part of a band and also becoming a teacher kind of forced me and also opened me up to the beauty of human connection. So that song is kind of about that and how it can be exhausting sometimes, but overall it's very worthwhile. But Spider, it does actually use the image of a spider, and it's not like something that's throughout the song, but I just kind of liked the connections.
The centerpiece of the album is a song called Baptism, which opens with the line, I'm finished with my pity parties. And the mm-hmm. chorus is, it's time to let it go, float away. So mm-hmm. it sounds like you're really shedding a skin there.
Yeah.
I'd like to know more about that song.
That song is probably one of our favorites to
play. It's my favorite to play.
And for me, I think the meaning of that song is important because it kind of summarizes what I gain from being in a band and from making music. I think a lot of times when something frustrates you, you can sort of let it weigh you down, or you can channel it into art. And that's something that I'm a creative writing teacher as well, and that's something that I'm constantly trying to impress upon my students. And it was like kind of teaching myself that same lesson, that I can be upset about things that are happening in my life, or I can use that energy and translate it into something positive and something creative, and then actually use that as a way to uplift myself.
Well, let's listen to Baptism. So do students know you're a singer in a band?
They do. Yeah. I try not to keep that a secret. But I don't think they come to my shows because I think a lot of times the shows will be in like venues that they can't get into and that sort of thing. But I do try to be open about the fact that I make music, and I think it keeps me too from seeming like a hypocrite that I'm teaching them to be creative. I also want them to know that I'm doing something creative as well.
And you can break that cliche about teaching.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, I consider the lyrics to songs to be a form of poetry. So yeah. That's something that I tell my students in my creative writing classes. I'm like, you might claim to dislike poetry, but if you like songs, if you like the lyrics to songs, then you like a form of poetry.
That's very closely related.
Yeah, they are very close related. So.
What's your impression of the, you know, Winston-Salem music scene circa 2015?
It's a family.
It is a family, yeah. There's so many good bands, so many good musicians.
It's not competitive. I think that's what I like the most about it is, I mean, you'll see local musicians at each other's shows constantly and helping each other to get shows.
We've had so much help from other bands.
Yeah, we're eternally grateful to, I mean, any musician who's ever helped us along the way, or even not even musicians, like Tucker at the Garage has been very supportive.
That's our
of
second
us.
Home.
yeah, we consider that our second home at this point. I think everybody just wants to see each other succeed, which is really heartwarming and encouraging. But I think also we kind of are spoiled by that. Like, we're used to people reaching their hands out to us in this community. And so now we're having to do that part of it ourselves. Like, we're having to be the ones reaching out and making things happen in other towns.
That's good, though.
Yeah.
It's all part of it.
It's a learning process.
We're learning a lot. So. Mm-hmm.
For the person who hasn't seen you before, this is their first time hearing you. What would you say to them?
Brace yourself.
Yeah, brace yourself. Keep an open mind. Just enjoy it. Like I said, the soundscapes, it's about sort of putting yourself in an environment with the sound itself, you know, and being open to that. I mean, I think music doesn't have to just be something that you listen to in the background of what you're doing.
Right.
I think it can also be something kind of like going to a museum and looking at a painting where you're being very purposeful about how you experience it. Not saying you shouldn't listen to our music as entertainment, but I think it's fun. I like to do that with songs. I mean, really give them my attention and not just use them as a
Me
form
too.
Of entertainment.
Before Aquatic Ceremony came in for the interview, you shared some questions for the band on Facebook. You definitely had some pretty intriguing questions. Thankfully, Aquatic Ceremony was game to answer. All right, here's the questions from Facebook. That'll never make it to air, but who knows? Does the name come from the line in Monty Python, Holy Grail?
Yes.
Yes, it does.
All right, so tell me about the band's name.
I mean, we actually spent a long time trying to figure out what we wanted to call ourselves.
We did. I don't really remember any of the other choices, actually.
I think they were all pretty lame.
They were.
And then we, I think, stumbled across this one phrase in the scene in Monty Python where you have...
Brilliant scene.
The peasant who's upset about how he's being treated and he's...
I'm being oppressed.
Yeah. Strange women lying in ponds distributing swords is no basis for a system of government. Supreme executive power is derived from a mandate from the masses, not from some farcical aquatic ceremony. That one.
Boom, that's where
there
it came
you go.
From.
Next question. How many cats are involved in the creative process?
At least like 30 or 40.
One real one and multiple imaginary ones.
They're all in my brain.
If ghosts can walk through walls and glide downstairs, why don't they fall through the floor?
Oh,
that's a good question.
Because there's gravity in the beyond.
Gravity in the beyond.
Gravity in the beyond.
Name of the next record.
Right.
All right, well, thank you for coming in.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Amy Fitzgerald and Chad McHenry. They're one half of the band Aquatic Ceremony. Aquatic Ceremony are playing this year's Fuzz Fest, which takes place in Winston-Salem from April 17th through the 19th. Aquatic Ceremony's self-titled debut CD is available locally at Reanimator Records, Underdog Records, and Coffee Park. You can download your copy at their Bandcamp site as well. We'll have a link to their music at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll have an enlightening analysis of the cultural phenomenon 50 Shades of Grey, some poetry in motion with Fire Pink Trio, and a look at how hometown sports helped shape America. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Coming up later in the show, we'll have contemporary and classical music with Fire Pink Trio and some revealing insights on 50 Shades of Grey with Wake Forest University Professor of Communications and Film Studies, Mary Dalton. But first, we're off to Mount Airy. Several weeks ago, the Mount Airy Museum of Regional History received quite a delivery. 21 crates full of the components to their newest exhibit, Hometown Teams, How Sports Shape America. Executive Director Matt Edwards and Curator of Collections Amy Snyder unpacked the boxes under the direction and assistance of Smithsonian Representative Terry Cobb. The exhibition is a traveling show and collaboration between the Smithsonian Institution and the North Carolina Humanities Council. The Mount Airy Museum of Regional History is the first venue in the state to feature the exhibit, which is made up of seven sections, including More Than a Game, Rooting for the Home Team, and a section on sports in movies. Hometown Teams, How Sports Shape America, opened on February 28th and runs through April 11th. The exhibition will feature history talks, storybook museum for kids, and companion exhibits such as the Mount Airy Sports Hall of Fame. Executive Director of the Mount Airy Museum of Regional History, Matt Edwards, spoke with David Ford.
You guys have won, over the years, some pretty big awards. What are some of the achievements that have gone on during your tenure that have been particularly effective?
Well, I think the North Carolina Museums Council Award of Excellence last year was awarded for a program we developed called Geocaching for History, which is kind of a digital scavenger hunt that utilizes GPS technology as a way to explore history where it happened rather than just inside the museum's four walls.
How would it look or feel?
Well, the easiest way to do it today is you actually come either to the museum or to Reeves Community Center and rent a GPS unit that comes preloaded with these destinations, with the coordinates for where these caches are hidden. And then you take your unit and you take the clues within there and you go look for this hidden thing. Once you find the hidden information thing, whatever it happens to be, if you've got a smartphone with you, you can actually take and scan a QR code, those funny little square codes that people are putting on stuff these days.
Oh, yeah.
You can scan those with your phone, and it'll actually take you to an online exhibit or really an interpretive site. It may be some primary source material. One of my favorite ones is actually the site of the Mount Airy Granateers baseball stadium, which is now right behind where City Hall is. And there's a marker for home base, and we've got a cache close by. And in the archival materials available online, there are photos of the pennant-winning team. There's a picture of a couple that were married on the pitcher's mound. And there's a great letter that was written to the league complaining about the quality of officiating at the Mount Airy Stadium.
How far back are we going for that team?
They were in operation from, I think, 48 to 52 or 53.
What a great way to relive history. So you're right there at the site, but you get there yourself. It's sort of, you have that, it's like an independent study sort of.
Exactly. You know, you want to get people moving, and you want people to realize that history happens all around them. And so this physically allows you to go to the space and to see where it happened and hopefully be able to draw some sort of a personal connection with it.
Well, that kind of leads right into this exhibition, if ever there was one, Hometown Teams. I mean, it doesn't get much more personal than that.
Absolutely.
This exhibit really is interesting at so many different levels. Conceptually, what did you latch on early on when this came about and compelled you to really apply to have the exhibit?
Well, when I came to the museum in 2009, we started talking about ways to incorporate, quite honestly, sports. We did an early program called White Liquor and Dirt Tracks that focused on the NASCAR connection in our region. And we were looking for ways to reach out to a new audience. Folks that might not be the traditional museum goer. And so we had planned to do some sort of a sports exhibit, potentially working in collaboration with the city and county sports halls of fame as a way to do this. We just had to find the right opportunity. In 2010, we hosted the first Smithsonian Museums on Main Street in North Carolina. It was called New Harmony, Celebrating American Roots Music. And so we had some history with the program, and we've been watching what the new programs were coming up. And when this one came onto the radar, that was, for us, the logical extension of that plan to incorporate this permanent exhibit.
This seems like the ideal venue for kind of tying into the community itself.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that we're required to do as part of this is to create some companion programming and some sort of a companion exhibit, which again goes back to that plan that we had all along. You know, but what we want to do is go out and get folks involved and excited about this stuff and coming into the museum. And so we've been able to reach out into our community, and we're going to be doing programming on everything from the Textile League basketball teams in the 30s, 40s, and 50s to the history of Mount Airy football and its statistical analysis. I mean, it's amazing the amount of information that is out there in lay historians and folks who really compile this stuff out of passion for it and that interest in sharing it with other people.
You're talking about just average sports fans out there and their kids from way back?
Some of them are just average sports fans. Some of them are full-on academics. And so our programs during the course of this exhibit really run the spectrum on that. We're also having Mike Wiley, who's a pretty well-known African-American actor, who's going to be coming in and doing a one-man show on Jackie Robinson. And so that's, again, it kind of allows us to tie in another arts aspect beyond just the visual arts that you would have in the exhibit itself. And if you don't know Mike, I would certainly encourage you to check him out. MikeWileyProductions.com, phenomenal. He travels all over the country doing these one-man shows. Great guy, taught at Duke for a long time, and now he's doing mostly performances.
And it's a one-man show based on the life of Jackie Robinson. Yep. He is Jackie Robinson?
He is Jackie Robinson.
Oh, neat.
Well, he's Jackie Robinson and about a dozen other people during the show, but they're really great performances.
You're talking about our companion exhibit developed for this exhibition.
Sure. Well, one of the things that we had to do for this exhibit was create some sort of a companion exhibit, which really tied into our long-term goal of creating a permanent exhibit at the museum about local sports and sports history. And so we're currently working on the final stages of that exhibit development, and we'll have a nice piece in place. I'm not sure it will be in place by the actual open date, but what that's going to allow us to do is actually come back about halfway through the exhibit and have a re-grand opening for the new exhibit as a way to kind of keep folks interested and excited about what's going on at the museum, along with all these weekly programs that we have.
Sports, obviously an indelible part of our culture, of our history, but the community, as we've talked about here, but how does it compare to other countries? I mean, I remember soccer being big in Mexico and stuff, but in terms of hometown teams, that whole phenomenon, is that a uniquely American thing, this hometown thing?
You know, it's hard to say. I've traveled a good bit. I mean, I spent a good bit of time in Latin America, and you have those connections to your professional sports teams, but I've never really seen as much of that on a grassroots hometown level. In my experience, a lot of countries abroad really kind of funnel folks into professional athletics from a pretty young age. And so I've not seen the same kind of high school or collegiate emphasis on organized sports as much from a competitive standpoint, but rather more from a recreational standpoint.
And I'm no expert there either, but it just seemed like in certain parts of the country, certain towns in Oklahoma or in Texas, I mean, high school football is so huge, it just grabs the imagination of entire communities.
Well, and that's really the heart of this exhibit is looking at how, you know, my thumbshell synopsis of this exhibit for folks is about sports and the creation of the American identity. In going through the Smithsonian paperwork, I couldn't find anything that succinct in there. Everything they had was a long explanation of what we were looking at here. And so that's my one-liner that I give to folks.
I think that says a whole lot. I mean, on the dark side, there's an element of hero worship within sport, even at the local level, that's a little bit, can be a little alarming because we turn our back on so many other aspects of what's going on there. But at the same time, on the flip side, as Billie Jean King said, in terms of role models, champions keep playing until they get it right, which I think is so telling. And that's kind of the ideal.
Absolutely. And, you know, and the great thing about this is that they have focused in this exhibit not just on the traditional big sports that we might think about, football, basketball, baseball, but they've also really latched on to a lot of the regionally specific sports or smaller, lesser known sports, whether those be the hockeys or the field hockeys or the lacrosse or the whatever, those kind of smaller swimming. I mean, not that swimming's not a huge thing, but it's not one of those big three sports that you think about when you think about your traditional season.
Because there are no big name hero names within community sport, can you give me a glimpse at some of the things that spill out if I walk through the exhibit? What sorts of things I might learn?
Well, I think they're going to talk about things as mundane as the fields of play and how that field of play impacts our idea of space and space usage. It's going to talk about topics as complex as how did sports impact race relations and desegregation and things of that, Title IX with women in sports, you know. So there's the full gamut of things that they're going to explore here.
So what kind of folks played on these hometown teams?
I think that you get all types on hometown teams. And that's the great thing about American sport. You know, it's something that really kind of developed in that kind of post-Victorian era. You know, in that Victorian era, you've got the Industrial Revolution and increased accessibility to resources that were previously unavailable and, quite frankly, to free time that was previously unavailable. And so you start seeing this development of formal and informal sport and game during that time period that eventually leads into the organized sports that we have today. And the great thing about them early on is that anybody could do them. And still today, anybody can do them. You know, you've got youth league baseball or soccer or pick your seasonal sport where any kid in the community can come in and be involved in this stuff and become a player, as it were, on one of those teams. And you know, that then continues up into the high schools And their offerings vary according to the size and location and community interest.
The way you just described it, especially the historical perspective, I think it's great. It ties into the this the whole melting pot. You can pull yourself out of the bootstraps and be whatever you want to be in this fine country.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And it's funny that you can also track in many of the communities the development of some of the sports that gain popularity. And one of the things that we're kind of looking at in our permanent exhibit is how did we get to where we are today in terms of sports in our community? And one of the things that was fascinating to me was the connection between the early Victorian sport and of all things, NASCAR racing. Mount Airy was a community that was known for foot racing and more than that, for horse racing early on. And that eventually kind of helped give way to the early NASCAR industry. Mount Airy was one of the earliest NASCAR tracks. It was in operation in 1948 or 49, again, about the same time as the Graneteers, 48 or 49 to about 51 or 52. Just operated a few years, but most of the big name groundbreaking NASCAR folks raced at Mount Airy, many of them for their first ever races. And that's a great connection with our community. And part of that has to do with that racing heritage that went back to the horse racing and the foot racing and the things that started in that Victorian period and then kind of extended forward. Since that time, Mount Airy is not exactly a hotbed of NASCAR activity, but there's still a pretty strong connection. And there are a lot of folks from the Mount Airy community that are still directly or indirectly connected with the industry.
Executive Director of the Mount Airy Museum of Regional History, Matt Edwards. You can catch the traveling Smithsonian exhibit, Hometown Teams, How Sports Shape America, at the museum through April 11th. The museum is open Tuesday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. The exhibit also features history talks, storybook museum for kids, and companion exhibits, such as the Mount Airy Sports Hall of Fame exhibit. You can find out more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. We have one more short break to take, but when we come back, it's 50 Shades of Grey and Fire Pink Trio's music for flute, viola, and harp when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Later in this hour, we'll go behind the scenes with Mary Dalton's take on the book series and film 50 Shades of Grey. But first, it's David Ford and some poetry in motion.
Fire Pink Trio is violist Sheila Brown, flutist Deborah Reuter-Pivetta, and harpist Jacqueline Bartlett. Their debut album titled Poetry in Motion is out on the MSR Classics label, and Fire Pink is out to celebrate with a free concert this weekend featuring music from the new CD. Dan Locklear's Dream Steps, Manuel Moreno Buendia's Suite Popular Española, Sonny Burnett's Cruisin' with the Top Down, and the Sonata for Flute, Viola, and Harp by the father of this wonderful trio combination of instruments, Claude Debussy. Jackie, who came up with this wonderful combination of instruments? And why does it sound so good?
Oh, Mr. Claude Debussy.
Is he the guy?
He's the guy. Great French composer, and loved the harp, loved the flute, and loved the viola. And so he actually was the first person to compose for this instrumental combination.
I understand from Ben Rowe's meticulous notes on the liner notes here that this combination of instruments almost didn't happen from Claude Debussy.
That's true. This is the very last completed work that he wrote, and he died shortly thereafter. And so while he was writing this, he was at a seaside resort in France, and cancer was raging through his body at the same time. So I think this trio is one of the most exquisite works of Debussy's. It was kind of a culmination of all of his years of passionately writing for all instruments.
Must be a big Debussy fan too. I mean, he wrote great for your instrument.
I am, and this is quite a virtuosic work. I think it's the most virtuosic work that he wrote that includes viola. And it's such a pleasure to play with this combination of instruments, especially with these two ladies, because I can really maximize the sides of the viola that oftentimes people didn't realize you could write for. You know, that the viola can really be virtuosic in the high registers, and then we have these gorgeous chocolatey registers as well. And so I can kind of bring out the darker side of the flute, which a lot of people don't think of the flute as having.
Until they hear Debbie Pavetta crank
that's
it
right.
out.
That's right. And you know, Debbie played viola.
What? Now, I had no idea.
I did for one whole year in fourth grade.
That's why you all pierce so perfectly. In general, I got to say, I mean, listening to this piece, it's such an emotional journey. And then the final movement, so intense. And I'm looking at the piece, it's close to 20 minutes long and wondering, is it tough to keep your concentration up for the duration of that? There's a lot going on from start to finish here.
You know, we've played this piece hundreds of times now, and it never gets old. We say this almost every time we pull this piece back out because, of course, it's the most popular piece and the most well-known piece of our repertoire. And we love it so much. It's just, you're just always in love with this piece. You fall in love with it all over again every time you play it. So it's not even a labor of love. I mean, it's just pure fun and joy and, of course, going through these emotions. I mean, not all of them were happy, of course. I mean, there are many, many different sides to this music, but the sheer beauty of it is always a pleasure. And I don't feel, you know, that I have to worry about holding it together or anything like that, because it's just so wonderful. And you get into that world and that soundscape, and the rest is easy almost.
Nice. I've always liked this piece by Dan Locklear, Wake Forest University's own, a dance suite. It's Dream Steps. It teaches here on campus at Wake Forest University, and maybe best known for his the big work, like choral pieces and organ works. But he's got this knack in all genres for writing music that's, yeah, it's sophisticated, great craft, but it's accessible and fun to listen to.
Yeah, it's very listenable to the audience. And Dan is a delightful person. He's been really fun to work with over the years, and I was involved in the world premiere and actually in the forming of this piece.
What group was that with?
It was with Mallarmé Chamber Players.
That's right. From the beginning of it, the first movement, the outer movements are my favorite, I'll confess it, and the first movement, Barcarolle and Recitatives, starts out like a dream to me, and there's just nothing... Nothing imitates the beautiful water sounds of a boat song like harp, and then you've got this recitative with a flute chiming in. I mean, it's great stuff.
That's true. It's very beautiful, and harp is often a water instrument. It seems like I recorded his harp concerto also, and the second movement of his harp concerto is similar to the strumming of the harp in the first and fourth movements of the Dream Steps.
Uh-huh.
Yes, it's beautiful. The inner movements of Dream Steps are exquisite, each of them also. Each is very different.
Okay, Cruisin' with the Top Down by Sonny Burnett. A new composer to me, but I understand Sonny has many lives.
He does have many lives. He, as well as composer, is a musician playing flutes and saxophones.
Hmm.
And he's also an actor.
How about that?
And he's teaching right now at Georgetown University in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. I like this piece. It's a lot of fun.
Well, it's a great piece because it's something different, a different style, kind of a little bit of Latin, jazzy, bluesy, just fun, just like cruising with the top down on a great sunny day, and it's just, you know, having fun, chilling.
It's Americana for sure.
Girls just want to have fun.
That's right.
We have a lot of fun in this trio.
We do.
Let me tell you.
Fun. Well, Fire Pink Trio, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, David. It's always a pleasure.
Flutist Deborah Reuter Pivetta, harpist Jacqueline Bartlett, and violist Sheila Brown. Together they are Fire Pink Trio. Their debut recording has just been released on the MSR Classics label, and you can hear it performed live in concert for free this Friday evening, March 6th at 7:30 in the Shirley Recital Hall on the Salem College campus. Fire Pink will be available after the concert to sign your copy of the new CD, Poetry in Motion, Music for Flute, Viola, and Harp.
For more on Fire Pink Trio, visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Okay, you've seen the trailer, perhaps you've seen the movie, or maybe you've encountered the risque licensed merchandise at a big box retailer. According to sales figures, you've likely read the book. 50 Shades of Grey has been everywhere lately, and Wake Forest University professor Mary Dalton doesn't think that's necessarily a good thing.
Desire is complicated. Yes, when it was a cultural phenomenon, I skimmed through the book 50 Shades of Grey, and I have also seen the film. I have three problems with this storyline, and I don't think you're going to find them maybe all that difficult to relate to. One of them is that the line in these stories between arrangements that are made between trusting, consenting adults is blurred with abuse. This is particularly problematic because the first part of the film is filled with conventionally romantic scenes and conventions, whereas the second part casts Anastasia in this relationship that's supposedly going to help her grow and mature, but really she is put into positions where she's going to face physical and emotional trauma that she's not prepared for, and Christian knows that. The second part of the film is decidedly darker. Anastasia thinks that she's ready to push the limits and to experience the sort of punishment that Christian thinks she deserves. In reality, she doesn't really know what she's asking for. She has no idea what it's going to feel like to be beaten with a whip by someone she thinks loves her. And Christian knows full well what she's getting into. I don't think there's any way, really, if you've read the books or seen the movie, to get around that. And that's a big problem. The second problem I have with it is that people don't change. I really don't think it's fair to ask people to change. And if someone does get into that position, in this case, we have these two characters, Anastasia Steele and Christian Grey, and she asks him to fundamentally change who he is. And not in the first movie, but if you've read the summaries of the other storylines online, as I have, you know that eventually she succeeds and he changes. No longer does he have this playroom where he wants to indulge in all kinds of domination and all kinds of sex games, but he changes into a different person. I just don't think that happens. And built on that is my biggest problem with the movie in particular. The storyline is built on these unrealistic binaries. These are not real people. Well, now don't laugh. They're really not real people. Because it's built on this idea that you have Anastasia and Christian, who are these two characters who represent certain things. She's a virgin. She's pure. And this is essential for the story to work because she doesn't have enough experience to understand that the scenarios he presents to her are not what most people really do together. This is important, though, because you have her on the one hand, him playing this really corrupted sort of character, which gives him a certain amount of knowledge and power that she does not possess. And that's going to be true for all of these other binary sorts of relationships. She comes from modest means. She works in a hardware store as a college student. He's incredibly wealthy, although we're not quite sure at the age of 25-ish how he has accumulated a multi-billion dollar multinational corporation. She's unsure of herself. He's unfailingly confident. He's unflappable. She's unsophisticated. He's worldly. It's a power balance that you can't really overcome except by going back to that idea that people can change, this idea that she can change him. And that's a big problem for a film that I think is going to ultimately, even though it's R-rated in the theaters, it will be widely available on other platforms soon. And ultimately, I think this is a story that many young people are going to engage. If there is one reason, aside from curiosity, to see 50 Shades of Grey, it would be Dakota Johnson. The role is not particularly well written. In some ways, there's not a lot to work with. But she is a compelling screen presence, and I really can't wait to see what she's going to do next.
That's Behind the Scenes with Wake Forest University Professor of Communication, Film Studies, and Women's and Gender Studies, Mary Dalton. Before we end this week's Triad Arts Weekend, we'd like to leave you with one more song from Fire Pink Trio. This piece is called Doppler Effect.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. I'm technical producer Eddie Garcia. Our executive producer is David Ford. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Elena Dolman. You'll find podcasts, archived episodes, and links to all of our guests and events and more on our website at wfdd.org. Once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend. As always, if you have questions, comments, or suggestions, send us an email at triadarts@wfu.edu. And you can follow us on Twitter at Triad Art Speak. I'm Eddie Garcia. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.